Matter is 54537, Thomas Pack et al. The parties are ready to proceed. Please do so. Please state your name for the record so we have it, and if you wish to reserve any time. Thank you. Counsel, and if you wish to reserve any time,
we'll be back. Reserve 5 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, once again, I am Charles Mihalik. This is Daniel Carvalho, and we represent the appellants, Thomas Pack and Son Cav, in this matter. Does the court require a brief recitation of the facts?
Only as it's pertinent to what you wish to argue.
Fairly, Your Honor. On September 8, 2009, this appeal was filed from the district court decision of Judge Kadish. And what Judge Kadish had found was under NRS 41A, the medical malpractice statute of limitations, would prevent a claim for contribution and indemnity. This court's decision in Saylor versus Arcata did not come out until March 4th, 2010. And the Saylor opinion would state that the medical malpractice statute of limitations 41A does not apply to claims for contribution and indemnity. So we know from this that Judge Kadish did make an error in that judgment, and the case should be reversed. Now, in this court's decision in Saylor, under footnote 2, there was a mention of other motions that had occurred in Saylor, where there was a motion that the claim for contribution was premature. And this court held that those motions should be heard upon remand. And this court could very well simply follow along this decision in Saylor and do the same. But I surmise that because we're having oral argument today, that this court wants to take the opportunity to further elaborate on contribution and indemnity claims. When one party is called upon to pay for the damages which is caused by another, then that first party should have a remedy. I think we can all agree upon that. It's what's equitable and it's what's fair. Otherwise, the second party would be unjustly enriched. So the question is, how are we going to exercise that right? How is it that it's going to be equitable? And Nevada has come up with two ways of doing that. The first way is contribution under NRS 17225, and the second way is through indemnity. Now, it is our position that contribution does not require a payment before you can exercise that right. And that is under 17.2251. That subsection states that where there are two or more parties, persons who are liable, that there is a right of contribution among them, even though judgment has not been recovered against any of them. And that is a substantive right. That is not a procedural right. Respondent would have you believe that that subsection is merely talking about procedure. It is not. The procedure that is used to bring that right is NRCP 14A. That's when you have a third-party claim. And I would point the court to your prior lives as district court judges. When someone would bring a third-party claim for contribution and indemnity, that's what they were exercising. They were exercising their rights under 17.2251 and NRCP 14A.
Isn't part and parcel of your argument, or part and parcel of that claim, the medical malpractice aspect of the contribution indemnity claim? I mean, you've got to show that there was some type of malpractice in order to prevail on an indemnity and contribution claim. So why shouldn't an expert affidavit be required, and why wouldn't that claim, that complaint, be void from the very beginning?
That's a very good question, Your Honor, and I can answer it this way. We have admitted in our opening brief that an affidavit was unfortunately not attached to the complaint. And that complaint would be void, but what Judge Kadish said and what this court has said in Washoe Medical is that those complaints should be dismissed without prejudice. Had the complaint been dismissed without prejudice, we would have filed a new complaint that very same day or the very next day attached with the affidavit. So even though the complaint is void, our time limit, our time for bringing a claim for contribution and indemnity has not run. That is the difference between the claims in Washoe Medical where the time is already run. At that point, you're unfortunately out of luck. But
that was based upon the statute of limitations, but were you precluded in any way from bringing a another claim at that point and attaching an affidavit, filing a complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. When Judge Cage said, with prejudice, that would preclude us from filing a new complaint. And that's a distinction that I made in the opening brief, that the dismissal, had it been without prejudice, would have allowed us to file the complaint the next day. And so we should have been able to file that complaint because the case should have been dismissed without prejudice. Let me go back to the reasons why we're arguing about contribution indemnity and why it's such an important issue. There is such an unfairness that it's going to result if the respondent's position is kept. And because respondent is saying, well, it's premature for you to file a claim, and at the same time, he's saying, well, it's too late for you to file a claim. And I'll explain that. If we have a plaintiff who gets involved in a taxicab automobile accident, and that plaintiff files right before the statute of limitations against the taxicab company, we answer the complaint, we go through discovery, and then we find out we think there's some liability on the part of one of plaintiff's physicians. If we haven't yet paid, and that's what respondent is saying, we haven't yet extinguished the liability, he's saying, well, you can't bring the claim for contribution and indemnity. At the same time, he's saying, well, once you pay, you still don't have a claim for contribution because the statute of limitations had extinguished the liability, not your payment. This fallacy would prevent contribution and indemnity in Nevada. And I'll give you another example. We have a driver who has a passenger, and those two get involved in an accident with a second driver. The passenger waits until 2 years before the statute of limitations would expire. And then the passenger brings a claim only against the driver of vehicle number two. Maybe it's their friend or they don't want to sue the driver for whatever reason. The driver of vehicle number two now looks at the case and says, hey, I think driver number one was speeding. Under respondent's position, he's got to pay first before bringing that claim. And even if he does, the argument is going to be, well, the two-year statute of limitations expired. That extinguished the claim, so you do not have a right of contribution. We are essentially rewriting the entire law of contribution so that no one could ever have a claim. The way that the laws work in the situation in the court system, we are 4 years or 5 years in before you ever get a trial. And once you do have a trial, any statute of limitations, 1 year or 2 years, is going to expire.
Do you have any comment in terms of what you're trying to go forward with in light of Rodriguez versus Prima Donna as the equitable issue as to an active wrongdoer?
I would say, Your Honor, a couple of things regarding active and passive liability. I do not believe that allegedly what happened with Dr. LaTourette, we were active in that. It was, and I seem to view active and passive liability in that sense, in that Dr. LaTourette committed his liability and we were passive in that. We had no responsibility for that. I would note that under Doctors Company versus Vincent, this court said, you know, Nevada has not yet adopted partial equitable indemnity. And I think equitable indemnity is not something this court needs to reach because I think it is clear that we had a right to bring a third-party claim for contribution. Certainly the statute hadn't expired yet, and we have that right under 14A 17-2251. But if this court wants to talk about indemnity and say, no, there is no right of contribution, then this is the case in which to enact partial implied indemnity. We cannot leave motorists in Nevada without a remedy. Before they are even sued, before they even get notice that someone is asking them for millions and millions of dollars, they would be precluded from bringing a claim for contribution or indemnity. That is leaving every motorist in Nevada without a remedy. They have to pay the entire liability even if they believe that 90% of the liability was caused by another party. Nevada, that would be, in my estimation, an absurd result. And I've cited cases in our brief that would, Roland versus Skaggs for one, that says this is an absurd result to leave a person in that position without a remedy. Another case we cited was Arzabal Medical Center. Again, we're talking about an absurd result. Before a defendant is ever served, they are going to be barred from filing a claim for contribution or indemnity. The respondent talks about the purposes of subsections 1, 2, and 3, and he says, well, subsection 2 is providing a remedy as far as payment. But the purpose of subsection 2 simply says we are going to limit the recovery to the equitable share more than you have paid. So if you pay more than your equitable share, that's all you're going to get back. You're not going to get back your entire sum.
Okay, let me ask you, so you would consider under our case law that the tort of Mr. Pack and this accident here would not be considered an independent wrong, or what's your position on that?
I do not, and I understand the court's concern. In my estimation, because of if we're not going to provide a right under contribution, then certainly this active, passive, independent wrong needs to be broadened. And that, no, we did not have any active involvement in the malpractice. Certainly, he may have decided for whatever reason to see Dr. LaTourette for treatment, but we didn't necessarily cause that malpractice. We're only liable for that under an operation of law that's been around since 1963. And unfortunately, that saddles taxicab companies with being responsible for that. If it wasn't for that operation of law, that legal requirement that we pay for them, then we wouldn't have to cover that amount. And maybe that's another way to look at it, Your Honor. We do have some sort of a relationship between them by operation of law. We're forced under Hanson and Collette to pay for the subsequent malpractice.
Counsel, you're at 3:30 at this point.
Yes, so I was going to say that, Your Honor. I would like to reserve the rest.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Robert Eisenberg for the respondents. We are contending that this Court should apply the well-established doctrine that district judge's decision will be affirmed even if the judge used the wrong reasoning, if there are other independent grounds for the affirmance. And here we contend that the complaint should have been dismissed on the other grounds that were alleged in the motions to dismiss, namely failure to state a claim for indemnity contribution and the affidavit requirement.
Within that litany of what you put forth, the concern is the with prejudice portion. How do we deal with that?
If the court applies the Saylor case, what the judge did, she said, well, normally under the statute it would be without prejudice, but because I'm dismissing it based on statute of limitations ground, it will be with prejudice. If the court applies the Saylor case, then you could say that it should have been without prejudice. But with other independent grounds for dismissal on the indemnity and contribution, then there still is a solid basis for affirming this judgment.
Assuming that argument doesn't fly to independent grounds, if you were looking strictly at the dismissal under the statute of limitations and we find that that was incorrect and that the dismissal should have been without prejudice, then his argument was that they were prejudiced in the sense that they were precluded from filing another complaint. And the time is now run. They would have filed another complaint with a proper affidavit attached.
Well, as I pointed out in my brief, they had a choice when they were faced with the motion to dismiss based on the affidavit ground. At that point, the law was crystal clear that their third-party complaint had been filed without the affidavit, and the law was clear that it was going to be dismissed. So they had a choice whether they wanted to fight the motion to dismiss or whether they would just voluntarily dismiss it and file a new one. They took the choice of fighting it. And then when the judge relied on the ground she did, she had a basis for dismissing it with prejudice. And so what I pointed out in the brief here is they made their own bed, basically, and now they have to sleep in it. And so they can't really blame the judge for committing error in doing that when they're the ones who created their own dilemma. Now, as far as the result in the Saylor case, there is that footnote, too, where the court said there were other grounds for dismissal, and we're not going to reach those. When it gets back on remand, the district court can determine those. Saylor doesn't say the extent to which the record was developed in that case, and we can't tell from the opinion. In this case, the record is fully developed, and we contend that on this record, as a matter of law, the indemnity and contribution claims have to go. Now, on the contribution claim, counsel says, well, this is really an unfair result. This court has said over and over again that contribution is a creature of statute. And this court doesn't really have the power to judicially amend a statute. These statutes are crystal clear. One of them says that the settlement has to have extinguished it, the liability. The other statute, NRS 17.285, says that the liability had to have been discharged. And counsel says, well, that's not really fair. If it's unfair, they should go to the legislature and get the legislature to change those statutes, because those words are crystal clear. And the number one rule of statutory interpretation is that if a statute is clear, you apply it, you don't interpret it. There are plenty of unfair things in litigation. In fact, in contribution itself, if you think of the good faith settlement wiping out a claim for contribution, you might have a multi-million-dollar case. If somebody has $15,000 liability policy insurance, they might settle and get a good faith determination, and it would wipe out a contribution claim. That's what the legislature said. You could argue that's not fair, but it's the legislature's prerogative to make that decision. So their argument is really addressed to the wrong forum here. If the cab companies want the legislature to change those statutes, they have the right to go to the legislature and try to get them to do it. The indemnity claim, the only way the appellants can really prevail on the indemnity claim is if they convince this court to overrule three completely separate requirements that this court has said over and over and again regarding indemnity. Number one, there has to be a pre-existing relationship between the parties. Number two, there has to be an absence of active wrongdoing by the party seeking equitable indemnity. And number three, there's no apportionment. Equitable indemnity is all or nothing. Just case after case, this court has applied those requirements. As recently in Rodriguez versus Prima Donna, the court said that as far as the requirement of a relationship, implied indemnification should not be construed as permission to open a floodgate for cross-claim seeking indemnification where there's no connection between the cross-claimant and the party from whom indemnification is sought. In Doctor's Company versus, that was a contribution claim. But so the relationship requirement has been established over and over again, that there has to be a pre-existing relationship. Then there has to be no active wrongdoing. And that's the Reed case, Medallion Development, Piedmont, Black & Decker, Rodriguez, every case involving equitable indemnity in Nevada requires the absence of active wrongdoing. Now they say, well, Dr. LaTourette's alleged negligence happened a month after the car accident, so we really weren't active wrongdoers regarding his negligence. Well, I mean, you could dream up all sorts of hypothetical examples. If you had two cars crash into each other, one of them bounces off and another one crashes into it, are you going to say, well, there's a distinction between the two defendants? Or are you going to be drawing that kind of fine line and that kind of subtle distinction when this court's case law is crystal clear that the party seeking equitable indemnity cannot be guilty of active wrongdoing, which the cab company clearly was in this case? And then as far as partial indemnification, this court said in the Doctors Company case, 2004 case, Nevada has not adopted implied partial indemnity. Some states have it, Nevada doesn't. So if they want to prevail on the equitable indemnity claim, they've got to convince you to overrule the law requiring a pre-existing relationship, to overrule the law requiring the absence of active wrongdoing, and to overrule case law saying that we don't have partial implied indemnity.
Can you address counsel's argument regarding the statutory provisions that perhaps create a relationship?
That created the relationship?
Well, that indicates that there is a pre-existing relationship because of statutory...
I don't think he's relying on statutory law. I think he's relying on common law that says that when a tortfeasor causes an injury, the tortfeasor is going to be liable for subsequent. You know, if I'm injured and I get put in an ambulance and then the ambulance driver runs a red light
right.
and makes my injury worse, the initial tortfeasor is liable for that subsequent injury. I'm not aware of any case law that would create such a huge exception to Nevada's jurisprudence and say that that is somehow creates a relationship. What this court has said is that there has to be a pre-existing relationship between the parties, and that would be some type of business relationship, family relationship, contractual relationship, and most often it comes up in the context of a products liability case, like the Black & Decker case, where a company manufactures a component part that's defective, Black & Decker puts it on their drill, and then the plaintiff gets injured. So they have a pre-existing relationship. And it just seems like it would eliminate that requirement altogether if you adopted their view. And to get back to contribution, the requirement that number one, there had to have been a payment, and the statute is crystal clear on that, but number two, the payment had to have extinguished the liability. And I would just quote from the Doctors Company case where the court said, a tortfeasor seeking to perfect a contribution claim through a prejudgment settlement process must pay an amount in excess of his equitable share of liability and must explicitly extinguish the liability of the joint tortfeasor from whom contribution is sought as part of this settlement. And we contend that neither one of those requirements has been satisfied. Unless the court has any other questions, I submitted on that.
Thank you.
Your Honor, he brought up Doctors Company versus Vincent. That is true that under that subsection 3, you would have to make a payment. But what I didn't hear from counsel is any argument as to why subsection 1 doesn't apply. He cited no case, no authority for the proposition that you can't have a complaint, a third-party complaint, filed before judgment. We cited cases in our brief, and I raised them with you, from Missouri and from Maryland. The fact is, Your Honor, that this is not a huge exception. It would be a huge detriment if we were to preclude contribution claims in Nevada. That's the practical effect of what they're asking. You would never practically have a contribution claim. Either you'd have to pay first, spend huge amounts of money, potentially not giving up your right to have a trial, or by the time you do pay, oh, well, I'm sorry, the statute of limitations extinguished your liability, not your payment. Basically, every motorist is never going to have a contribution claim in Nevada if you adopt his reasoning. He says that the record is fully developed. Actually, I don't believe that's true. Judge Kadish never did get to rule on the merits of any of those other motions. The argument we've been talking now about payment and extinguishment, that was never brought up in front of Judge Kadish because payment hadn't been made. We filed a third-party complaint, and then we filed the appeal once the third-party complaint was dismissed. So she never got to reach the issue of extinguishment or payment. This is not a fairness. It does deal with fairness, but this is a legislative result. It would be an absurd reading to preclude a claim for contribution before it has arisen. And we've cited cases from other jurisdictions. The federal rules apply that way. 14A works that way. NRCP 14A works that way. And it would be an absurd result to say, no, wait a minute, you have to pay first. We have a cardinal rule in interpreting statutes that we avoid absurd results and we read subsections together. And you have to read subsection 1 as allowing that type of claim. I will make a point. You were talking about the what the rationale is for having liability from one tortfeasor to another, and I was referring to Hanson and Collette, which would say, as a matter of operation of law, in 1963, 8 years before I was even born, it was required that tortfeasors now have to pay for subsequent malpractice. If we had a different statute, a different way where we could apportion that liability during trial, it might be a different matter. But under a respondent's position, that's not going to happen. So you're going to be, as a matter of operation of law, fully responsible for those damages. So there's the duty. There's the relationship. Law has made it possible. Law is required that we have to make that payment. And it would be unfair, in equity, to leave that person without a remedy, assuming that we don't have a contribution claim. I would say it's quite clear that we do have a contribution claim under 17.225.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thanks, counsel, this morning for the arguments presented. This matter will stand submitted.